Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Today, Susan Moon has been here before. She's been a Zen student since 1976, practicing with Mel Weitzman at the Berkeley Zen Center. She now practices primarily with the Everyday Zen Sangha. And in August of 2005, she received lay entrustment from Zoketsu Norman Fisher. She's the editor of Turning Wheel, the quarterly magazine of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and she's also an author. She's the author of The Life and Letters of Tofu Roshi, and the editor-author of Not Turning Away, The Practice of Engaged Buddhism. Well, welcome, Susan, to the Buddhist Fellowship.
Thank you very much. It's really nice to be back here. I appreciate you welcoming me here as a honorary gay man for the morning. I was here just about a year ago. So I just came back from Chicago last night. I've been traveling a lot, and I'm a little tired and a little sleepy. And this morning, during the meditation, I was feeling a little sleepy, so I'm hoping that I give a really stimulating talk this morning and keep myself from falling asleep in the middle of my own talk. I'm really sorry to hear of Roger Corliss's death. I knew him slightly and really respected his long years of commitment to the Dharma and his scholarship, and I had read his writings and published some of his writing in Turning Wheel. And so I know he was an important part of this Sangha. My condolences to you on his death. As it happens, what I have chosen to talk about this morning is death. So I guess that fits right in. And the reason is that my mother died recently. The reason I came back from Chicago last night is that I was there for the final bout with my three siblings of vacating my mother's apartment. There are four of us in my generation, and none of us live in Chicago, but she lived there much of her life. And so she died on October 13th after 3 weeks in the intensive care unit. She was 84, and she was doing really well, and I was very engaged with her in some writing projects. She was a writer also and a poet, and I was about to go visit her, and then she was in a car accident. So even though she was 84, her death did not come from being old, it came from the car accident, and we almost thought she would make it. She almost survived, but so it was very painful in many respects and a really huge loss. And it's for me, I find when I give Dharma talks that it's the most helpful way I can offer myself is to really speak about what I know in my life and how that might or might not, hopefully, will connect to what others are experiencing in their lives. So, because my own mother's death is what is most present for me now, I thought I would take that as my topic. And it is a topic that is, of course, very central to Buddhist practice, the topic of life and death, and what is death anyway. Buddha, when he went out from his sheltered life as a young prince, saw a sick person, an old person, and a corpse, and his questions were, what is this? How? And so what is death was one of the main questions that his spiritual search was about. And I think it was what brought me to Buddhist practice in the first place, was a kind of some fear of death, some feeling that I wanted to understand what it was. I wanted to get ready to die before I died, and I wanted to, and I thought maybe Buddhism would help me. And I think maybe it's helping me along the way. So since we're all gonna do it, there's not too much point in refusing it, you know. We might as well get with the program. When my siblings and I and my children and nieces and nephews, we all gathered in Chicago at some, and so before my mother died, she saw and spoke with all four of her children and all nine of her grandchildren and all of the various spouses, or some of the spouses that existed. So that was a kind of a wonderful, loving coming together, and something to be really grateful for. And we really attended to her in the hospital in this extremely intimate way. We were fortunate to be able to stay there. We had to take turns a little bit, going back and forth to our lives and our jobs, but mostly we were there, and we were rubbing her feet and singing her songs and cheering her on. And it was a different kind of witnessing of a dying than sometimes people need to do, because sometimes you know somebody's dying and the person knows they're dying, and the task is to really help them and let go of them and say to them, you know, it's okay, we're ready for you to go, that kind of conversation. But actually, in my mother's case, it wasn't like that, because we were hoping she would live. And so it made it a different sort of a journey, and with a kind of sudden U-turn at the end when we realized she really wasn't going to live. But we were saying to her, you can do it, you can do it. You know, hang in there, keep breathing. And so so that was part of, I think, what in the moment made her death really, really sudden, is not only was she didn't really have time to get ready for it, but we didn't really either. I mean, we did at the very last minute, but she was pretty doped up and pretty asleep for the last 36 hours or 24 hours when we actually realized it was the end. So she, at the very end, she went to the palliative care floor of the hospital, which is for people who are dying and to just make them comfortable. And the doctors said they didn't know how long it would be. She might die in a few hours, she might die in a few days. And she was on she had an oxygen mask on. She had been on a ventilator with a tube down her throat and for 2 weeks, and then she was taken off the ventilator when we thought she might make it on her own without the ventilator, and she did really well for the first couple of days, and then she just weakened and weakened, and we had already made the decision that we would not re-intubate her and put the tube back down her, which is something she'd always said, don't ever put a tube down my throat. So that was another one of the issues, many issues we were confronting, was this tube. And when my sister got there, she was the first to arrive after my mother's accident. She got there the very next morning, and my mother was already in the hospital. She'd had her spleen out, and she was already on the ventilator with this tube down her throat. So she couldn't speak, and Nora, my sister, knew, and was actually had the medical power of attorney for my mother. She knew that my mother didn't want this and had signed all kinds of living wills and so on. And she said to the doctors, but she said she never wanted a tube down her throat to help her stay alive. And the doctors said, yes, but this is different. This is different. It's not like you're keeping her alive and keeping her from her death. She had a car accident. She's getting better. Anybody would need a tube after this, and it's just a temporary thing. And we were quite convinced by that argument, and I think that was a reasonable decision to make. So, but still, it was hard to see her there with this, all this stuff in her, and to not be able to speak. And so, anyway, after 2 weeks, we were so glad that she could get it out, she could speak, and we hoped that things were going to be okay. So it was really the final weakening that happened at the end, that she just couldn't get back her own breathing. So anyway, there she was in palliative care, and she had this oxygen mask, which is not nearly as invasive, of course, as a tube down your throat. It's just a mask over her face. And her doctor said, well, you might want to take the oxygen mask off. She'll be more comfortable without the mask on. And the point now is to just make her comfortable. You could put the nasal cannula in, just the little tubes that are even less than the oxygen mask. So that's what we decided to do. And there were six of us in the room with her at this point, three of her children and three of her grandchildren, and who are very young adults, the grandchildren, most of them. Teenagers, 20s. So she's a mouth breather, so we didn't know how well the nasal cannula would work to deliver oxygen. But anyway, the nurse, we said, okay, it was about, it was 10 o'clock at night, and we said, okay, and the nurse took off the oxygen mask and didn't even get the nasal cannula in. My mother died in a minute and a half from the time the oxygen mask was taken off. And we were kind of thinking, oh, a few hours through the night, a few days. So there was this final moment of shock of being with her as she died. And we were right around the bed, and she was sort of gasping a little bit. But she was asleep, and she was from the morphine. And so, you know, I don't think she was in a panic, but it was just an amazing experience. I don't know if any of you have been with a person at the moment of death, but I could just see her color change. Her face went white in front of my eyes, and her, you know, she was trying so hard to breathe all this time that her chest had been really just heaving, and then all of a sudden it stopped, and she was white, and she was dead. And this is what I want to talk about. What happened? What is it? It's a mystery. It is such a mystery. This life we have, and then it's gone. And I'm still really trying to plumb the depths of this mystery and this incredible miracle and gift that we have to be alive. And we, too, are going to just be gone. But when we were standing there and she was alive, and then just a moment later, she wasn't there anymore. I mean, even though she was very sick, she was still alive. My mother was still in the room, you know? And then she was no longer in the room, but I never saw her leave. Nobody got up and went out. What happened? And I think this question is something really helpful for all of us to consider as we think about what is our life, you know, what is the difference between us and those who have passed on and those who have not yet been born? Is there a difference? And at some level, we also know from Buddhism that no, there is no separation. And there's this boundary between life and death, but actually we're all included in the universe and in Buddha nature, and it's all, you know, surrounding us, whether we're alive or dead. Our Buddha nature just is a stream that keeps going. But how can we experience that? There's a koan, a Zen koan, that I really have been appreciating a lot that I want to share with you. This is from, well, it's in a couple of koan collections. It's in one called the Blue Cliff Record, and it's in the writings of Zen Master Dogen, and it's an old Chinese Zen teaching story. So the story goes like this. Priest Jian Yuan of Tan once accompanied his teacher, Dao Wu, on a condolence call to a family funeral. When they arrived, he tapped the coffin and said, "Dead or alive, dead or alive." So you can imagine these two monks kind of like making a pastoral call to the family, but the student monk is quite rude. He's hitting the coffin with his stick. "Dead or alive, dead or alive." Jin Yuan said, Dao Wu said, "I won't say life, I won't say death." Jian Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Dao Wu said, "I won't say, I won't say." On their way back to the temple, Jian Yuan said again, "Dead or alive, dead or alive. Tell me, you should say it quickly, teacher, or I will hit you." Dao Wu said, "Hit me if you will, but I will not say." Jian Yuan hit him. So that too is a very radical act, especially in the extremely respectful system of the old Zen hierarchy and the master and the student. You know, for the student to hit his teacher is drastic. After returning to the monastery, Dao Wu said to Jian Yuan, "You should take leave for a while. I'm afraid if the head monk finds out that you hit me, he will make trouble for you." And I think he was watching out for his student. He didn't want him to get into trouble. After Dao Wu passed away, Jian Yuan went to see Dao Wu's successor, Shi Shuang, and told him the whole story and asked for guidance. He asked him again, "Was he dead or alive?" Shi Shuang said, "I won't say life, I won't say death." Jian Yuan said, "Why won't you say it?" Shi Shuang said, "I won't say, I won't say." Jian Yuan immediately attained realization. Well, as is often the case in these koans, it's, you don't really know why he got it one time and he didn't get it the other time. But anyway, that's the way it goes. You know, maybe it had something to do with his what he had for breakfast that day, but the combination of causes and conditions were just right for him to attain realization. So his question, though, I think, was the same question that, you know, came up for me when I saw my mother die. What happened? And I think the teacher in this story who won't say, he's not being coy, he's not withholding an answer that he could give. I think he is not answering and not saying because he can't say, because there isn't really a separation at some level between dead and alive. And how can he fall on one side or the other of this fence and give an answer that's only partial? He can't say. He doesn't know himself. And he wants the student to plumb the question himself in his own heart. And that's the only place to find the response or the answer to that question is in each of us in our own hearts. So his refusal to answer is very kind and very generous-hearted. If he gave an easy answer to the student wouldn't have the opportunity to really work with this very deep question. And the student continues to work with it. And in fact, coming back from the condolence call on the way to the monastery, the student's sense of urgency is so great that he hits his teacher. And that isn't so much a sign of the fact that he is a bad student who has no respect. It's rather, I take it in the koan, in the context of the koan, a sign of the fact that for him, this question has such tremendous urgency. He wants so badly to understand that he's even driven to striking his own teacher in hopes of getting a response. And then when his teacher dies, it's not here in the story, but it's kind of embedded in the story for me that perhaps his teacher's death further enriches that question, because his own teacher has now died. Is his teacher dead or alive? He's not looking at his coffin anymore, but his teacher is gone. But has his teacher gone? So then he, when he's asking his teacher's teacher the question again, he has a second layer, really, to the question. So thinking again about going back to my mother, or going back to anyone we know and have been close to who's died, and thinking about this koan, I can say to myself, well, when I was standing there in the hospital next to my mother's dead body, was she dead or alive? Well, of course she was dead. She was clinically dead. A coroner came into the room and signed the little thing that said she was dead. But in some other ways, she wasn't dead, and she is still not dead. And she is she's still alive in my memory and in the memories of all the people who knew her. She's alive in the genetic code that she's passed on in her children and grandchildren and now one great-grandchild, who I'll come to in a minute. And she is alive in the many things she wrote and the changes the things she did in the world that made the world a little bit different from how it was before. And all of us do that. You know, all of us change the world. And she's alive in... she's alive in my heart in a way that's not just memories of her, but I actually feel as though she's, now that she has died, she's more present with me than when she was living in Chicago. She's not living in Chicago anymore, so that Chicago is a couple thousand miles away. But now she's not a couple thousand miles away. She's right here in an odd way. She's sort of closer to me. And I find, and other people have said this, and I find I can talk to her. And I don't, you know, I can't talk to her in the sense of saying, gee, Mom, I saw this great movie you'd really like, the way I used to. What would you, I wonder what you think of this book. I don't talk to her in kind of very discursive ways like that, but it's just more of a, hi, Mom, I'm here, you're there, okay, I'm glad, we're together. It's just a completely, well, sort of wide and slightly abstract kind of conversation. And I'm sure you all have some sense of that from people you love and have felt close to who aren't with you in the moment, but you can still have a relationship. And it's amazing to me that I feel that it is true that one can have a relationship with someone who... across this line of life and death. So I think that this whole question of, you know, where did she go? Did she go anywhere? Is she alive or dead? It just keeps on being a koan for me. And it relates to me. It's also, well, where will I go? and so death is, you know, when we think about the loss that death is and dealing with death, there's really two parts to it in our everyday lives. At least for me, there's the part about trying to come to a place of accepting my own mortality and my own death. And then there's also the whole matter of accepting the deaths of other people and that loss. So my own death isn't a loss for me, the way the deaths of others I love are losses for me. I felt that so clearly when my mother died. It wasn't her problem, it was our problem, kind of, after she died. We were the ones. She wasn't in pain anymore, we were. And then, you know, you don't want to. The people who love us don't want us to writhe in pain because of their death. So in another way, we owe it to those we love to let their deaths be the gift to us that it can be. Because inside of every death, every painful death that we wish hadn't happened, there is a gift, which is the reminder that we're alive, and that we can treasure our life, and we can live with joy and gratitude and be grateful for this precious human birth. And I think that's the gift that every person who dies gives us in the form of a reminder of, hey, well, I'm not here right now writing a book with you, but you're there. Keep on doing it. So we owe it to them, I feel, to receive that gift. I've had it for years, a sign over my desk that says, "Don't think for a minute you're not going to die," which makes me really happy to see. People think I'm very morbid, but it has the same, it's a kind of memento mori, a reminder of death that, yeah, so I'm not dead now. Wow, I can just take another breath. How exciting. And it helps me to not sweat the small stuff and to just try to remember to do what I really care about doing. And that's why I think so many religious practices, not just Buddhism, but other religions too, have different kinds of ways of remembering death and keeping death present in our memory. And in Tibetan Buddhist practice, there are meditations on death and meditations on the charnel ground, where you meditate on a corpse and you meditate on your own body becoming a rotting corpse. And you do that in order to let go of your attachment to everything staying exactly the same, you know, to accept impermanence. And then you can be more fully yourself and live with a lot more joy when you can accept the impermanence of your life. And in Christianity, the central image of Christianity is of a corpse on a cross, but of course, the question, dead or alive, is very, very relevant to the whole idea of the crucifixion and the resurrection. That's both death and life, all in one thing. So you couldn't really say was Christ on the cross dead or alive either, I suppose. I'm not really a Christian, but I'm thinking about how close that is to the concern of all of us about, are we dead or alive, and how can we stay in touch with the fact that we don't ever die at some level. Way of working with death that I've experienced is I've been to Mexico, to Oaxaca, for the Day of the Dead celebrations. And they happen all over Mexico, but in Oaxaca they have really big fiestas. And the Day of the Dead is November 2nd. And it's a day when people connect with their families who have passed on. And it's a day for the It's related to Halloween, to All Souls Day, to many different festivals that in which the membrane between life and death gets very thin. And so I was traveling in Mexico, and I was there with my sister, and we went to the cemeteries. That's what people do. And the families go to the cemeteries where their father is buried, and the whole family goes there and stays all night long, and they the whole place is lit up with candles, and they're beautiful what do you call those orange flowers that snails don't like?
Marigolds.
Marigolds, yes. The whole place is covered with marigolds. Marigolds are somehow the flowers for the Day of the Dead, and they permeate, the smell permeates the air, and they're beautiful altars next to every single grave, and with photographs of the person who's died, and with their favorite foods, and you see their favorite drinks and candies and Coke and everything all laid out for them, and then the family sits around and they sing and they talk and they eat and they drink, and it's kind of like Thanksgiving, and it's a big family reunion, and some of the people who come to the reunion are dead and some of the people who come to the reunion are alive, and they do it every year and they just all get together. And it's just this great way of saying, yeah, you know, they happen to be on the other side of this particular little line, and I happen to be on this side, but really it's not a separation. I'm not going to let that keep us apart. So it's a great way to keep on remembering that we're all in this together, and that, you know, Buddha nature, or the universe, is taking care of all of us and holding all of us and all of our spirits. And when I was in Mexico that time, I got, you know, those little scenes that you can get of skeletons, those little Day of the Dead scenes. So I got a little box, and it has a birth scene, and it has the doctor and the nurse and the mother lying on the table with her knees apart and the baby coming out between her legs, and they're all skeletons, including the baby. And I just love it. I just feel like this is it. This is it. Birth and death, they're the same thing. They're the same thing. And so what I want to come to is my granddaughter. I have a new granddaughter who was born a couple of months before my mother died. And she's the first of that generation in our family. And I'm so excited, of course, to be a grandmother anyway. But, and her name is Paloma, and her parents, my son and daughter-in-law, live in San Antonio, Texas, which is unfortunately kind of far away. And my mother was really excited to have a great-granddaughter, and was very close to my son, Noah, who is her oldest grandchild. So she was really looking forward to meeting Paloma, which she never did. And that was one of our sad things. And but she knew Paloma was born, and that gave her great joy. So anyway, on my mantelpiece at home, I have this Day of the Dead box with the skeletons. And then on one side of it, I have a photograph of my mother, and on the other side of it, I have a photograph of my granddaughter. And they both made their, one came in the door and one went out the door, this just in the last few months. And it helps me so much to just say, yeah, this is what life is. You know, it just goes around, and the generations keep turning, and there's just so much to be grateful for, because, you know, we hope that our parents will die before we do, and, you know, when the children die before the parents, there's a different kind of grief, but this kind is part of the passing of the generations, and it's kind of the way it's supposed to happen. I mean, my mother was going to die sometime, so I can't get too angry about the fact that it happened. And then this wonderful other thing happened, that I got that a new life arrived in our family. And in the way, we need the old need to die in order to make room for the young. And in our own lives, we need to let go of things in order to make room for new things. And we need to have lots of little deaths in order to make room for new living things coming into our lives. So I want to tell you a story about, again, in the hospital with my mother. When she had had this ventilator in her for 2 weeks, and she was really struggling, we weren't sure if we really wanted her to want to live, and we thought she just needed all the encouragement she could get. And so I called my son Noah, who had said he'd come visit or anything he could do, he'd be glad to help. So he came to visit. I asked him to come and see her because I thought that would cheer her up. And subsequently, all the grandchildren did come. But anyway, he was the first one to arrive. Mm-hmm. And he came, and he was with her he was there for 2 days. And then he was there the day they decided to take out the ventilator. So they took it out, and we were all sort of waiting, is she going to do? Is she going to be able to breathe? And she breathed, and we were all so happy, and Noah was very happy, and she was so happy to see him. When he came in, she just reached out to him, and then when she had the tube out, she was able to talk to him, and he talked to her, and he told her that he was going to be coming back to Chicago for a conference in a couple of months, and he was going to bring Paloma, and he would introduce Paloma to her, and she said, "Oh, I can't wait, that's so wonderful." And then he left and went back to Texas thinking that she was going to make it. And then about 2 days later, she was failing. We didn't know for sure, but she was definitely not doing very well. And she was kind of confused, but she could talk. And she said, I want to curl up on my side. And so the nurses helped her lie down on her side. She said, "I have to get ready for the baby." And I sort of misjudged her, and I thought she was really delusional. And I said, "Mom, you know, you're not going to have a baby." And she said, I know. I need to get ready for Noah's baby. I have to make a place for Noah's baby." And she curled up on the bed, and I think she thought that Paloma was coming momentarily. And she curled up in this sort of half moon on the side, and I could just tell that she meant she was making a little spot, a little nest right in the bed, and she was just waiting for Noah to put her great-granddaughter right there, and she was going to curl right around her. And that didn't happen, but I realized later that she did make a place for the baby, that her death was a way of making a place for the baby, and her, you know, her way of being in the world. She was curling around a protected space kind of in the universe to make a place for the baby. So I'm left with that image of her. And I want to just end with a very short little poem. I want to have plenty of time for discussion because I'm really eager to hear what you all might have to contribute. And this is an author unknown. It's so simple and kind of unemotional. I just like the simplicity of it. "Empty-handed, I enter the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My comings, my goings, two simple things that got entangled." "Empty-handed, I enter the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My comings, my goings, two simple things that got entangled." So I would be glad to hear comments, questions, ideas. Yes?
One comment and one question. It does seem to me to have a son by the name of Noah and a granddaughter whose name really is Dove, but
yes,
Paloma, to have a mother who's made a little nest does indicate a certain generational connection.
Yes.
I would suggest that.
You know, it's funny, I never thought of the connection between Noah and Paloma. I mean,
well,
of the story. I don't know if they even thought.
They may even have another child named Flood. But my own comment, my own question really has to do with my own experience with my father's death, where I spent a whole week, 24 hours around the clock, with my father while he was dying in the hospital and holding his arms and crying the whole time and all that. And in my life, I came, and it's 40 years, it's a long time, this is he died in 76, so it's 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
In my whole life, while he was alive, I saw myself vis-a-vis him. That is, in contrast to him, and the moment he died, began this long process, which hasn't ended to this day, of his and my merging.
Mm.
And about 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with exactly the same disease he had.
Oh my
gosh.
Which
was a major disease. He didn't die of it, but it was a major disease.
Uh-huh.
I had gone through every single step of it.
Wow.
And some little barrier inside of me just melted when I got to merge once again. And some profound compassion rose in me for what he had gone through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, I really don't know the difference between between mm-hmm. life and death. Mm-hmm. I do know the difference between locations. This happened to be Chicago, mine was Denver. Mm-hmm. But my father and later my mother really did take up residence in Simon. Mm-hmm. And there has been this profound mm-hmm. and very alive continued experience. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's very beautiful. And I think it's really true that especially with parents, when our parents die, it gives us an opportunity. It's a kind of birth, really. I mean, I felt my mother birthed me a long time ago, and then she birthed me again by dying and liberating me into joining with her, just like you were saying. Yeah. Yes. We'll get you next.
I'm very moved by what you said. I'm not in an optimistic place about what you are, especially about myself, but also bring back the two things that just came up for me. One was being with my son when he died 15 years ago when he was 24. And also I worked and volunteered in the hospice with a number of people. That's a very profound experience. With others, in hospice, I sense, for me, my language is, I sense the spirit leading me.
You did, yes.
I sense that. But I'm also very preoccupied right now with the war. Mm-hmm. And keep reading about it. I met a veteran who was shot in the head at a conference. He was just there with somebody else. A very simple person that will really care for the rest of the world. And I was very taken with the picture of a young man who died at the time of the 3,000th death. And I was actually doing a visual where we were reading the names. But later on, I called his father.
Oh.
I called the family.
How did you know how to do that?
Found a small town in Michigan.
Wow.
Michigan. Only 2,000 people, but there are 51 people in the hospital. It's a Scandinavian name. And the first person I called, I called on that phone was a story.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And it was not a very
What was his response to being called by you? Was he?
I think the most emotional thing he's gay. I would say thank you so much. And, you know, we had the funeral just yesterday, and so on. So I have long
experience. Yeah.
I didn't even know that. Then he said, "Where are you from?" I said, "San Francisco." "You're calling me all the way from San Francisco to kill this deal?"
Yeah.
Doesn't mean anything to me anymore.
Yeah.
You know, with perception.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
But there was a very moving picture.
Yeah.
In the pot of his face. In a relaxed way.
I saw that picture. I remember that picture.
And the sound of that young man looking up.
Well, I think it was wonderful that you reached out like that, and probably his father might, you know, it will stay with him, that call, and you don't know what effect it will have. But I also am glad you brought up the war and the fact that I've been talking about the death of a mother, which is extremely close, but we also need to find a way of how do we be present with all these terrible, unnecessary deaths in the wars and suffering and other people who we don't know who die, and yet we still grieve those deaths as well.
I have two suggestions. One is you can go to a vigil every Thursday at 12 noon at the Civic Center. And the other one is there's a nonviolent action once a month. Next one will be February 1st from 2 o'clock at 1 o'clock to about 2:30 at the federal building where people lock the doors and die. And so
once a month, there's a number.
Once a month is a nonviolent action, and it's very moving to go.
That's great.
And the other is it's just a vigil every month.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody has time, just want to try it once and see.
Tell us one more time the time when how you know when the vigil is.
The vigil is at 12 noon.
12 noon.
Every Thursday.
Every week.
Every week.
Oh, okay.
Rain or shine. At the federal building, at the corner of Larkin and
Golden Gate.
Golden Gate.
Right, okay.
Anybody else?
Well,
and this is sponsored by the Buddhist Peace.
Yes, yes.
In part.
And it started right after.
Service committee for most of the work.
Yeah. They're good workers. You were going to say something. Thank you very much.
I was thinking about how, I'm pretty young, and how when you're young, you can kind of delude yourself that you're not going to die. You know, you don't really think about dying. You just kind of go on thinking that you're going to live forever.
Yes.
Unless you get sick. And then, you know, that becomes this thing where you feel like, oh, you're going to die the next day.
Mm-hmm.
How both are really just delusions.
Mm-hmm.
People who are young die.
Mm-hmm.
Getting accidents or,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have some disorder. Or
mm-hmm.
Just thinking about how. How you live with the knowledge that yes, you're going to die and you might even die tomorrow, but then for it to not, you know, control your life.
Mm-hmm.
How
right, that's a really good point. That you know, we know that we're going to die, but we don't know when we're going to die. And there's one Tibetan meditation on death has these little mantras you say to yourself. One of which is, death is certain, only the moment of death is uncertain. And you just say that over and over as you're meditating. Death is certain, only the moment of death is uncertain. So you're present with the fact that it could happen any time. But as you say, how can you be present with that without sort of walking around like, oh my God, is a brick right about to fall on my head? No, but it should be a way to be more fully alive, not a way to be more afraid. So it's a good one to work with. And we know that sometimes young people, especially teenagers, I think, and adolescents tend to be just really can't believe they're going to die. And sometimes there's a lot of risk-taking behavior that I think can be related to the fact that people don't quite believe. It's very hard for us to believe, even when we're old, that we're going to die. Yes?
I'm a little reluctant to bring this up, but I wonder if you have any thoughts, or, well, first of all, thank you very much for a lovely talk. It really moved me, and I appreciated it. What I wanted to talk about is, what about those of us who, through choice or situation or whatever, are not going to have quite as direct a connection with the next generation? And I'm of a generation of gay men where most of us kind of thought, oh, well, I'm gay, I'm not going to have kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's not the situation. There are gay men who are older than me who have had kids, and many in my generation and many who are younger who have worked out all these alternatives and ways. But for me, my experience and that of a lot of my friends was sort of like, oh, this isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some
mm-hmm.
of us have changed that, and I may
mm-hmm.
yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was thinking, well, as a good Buddhist, I really shouldn't be attached to the idea of having children. And, you know, but I just wonder, it's a little bit of a heterosexual privilege or coupled heterosexual privilege to kind of assume, oh yes, well, my children and grandchildren I'll go on in that way.
No, I'm really glad you brought that up, and you're absolutely right. It's I definitely acknowledge that it's a privilege to, I mean, I feel that it's a great privilege that I have children and a granddaughter, and it's not something to be assumed. I think that you know, I think all of you would have some ideas, and I'd like to hear about them too, about how you think about the turning of the generations when you are not expecting to have children, or, and I know also a lot of, it's not just about being gay, of course, it's also, I mean, I know a lot of straight women, or not a lot, but I have some friends who somehow they never got married, that, and that time ran out, and they're never going to have children, and there's a lot of reasons why a person could not have children, so, but being gay and of a certain generation is probably, it makes it more likely, of course, and I think there's ways that we all need to, you know, take care of each other's children, honor each other's children, but also recognize that there is some kind of longing, and how can we sort of share that longing to go on as a communal human thing that we know we're all passing on our best hope to the next generation, even if we're not passing on our own particular genes. How do we do that together? And I think that's a very valid question that you're raising. I wouldn't want people to be left out of this whole project if they wanted to be part of it in some way, and maybe there are ways to be part of it that we don't necessarily think of right off the bat.
We have time for just one more question.
Oh, okay. Well, does somebody want to respond particularly to this concern? Yes.
I feel it's a great honor not to have to have children. And thank God for the people that have the responsibility to raise children, and thank God that they're willing to do that. And I, you know, my life is about something different. I never thought I'd have children. Even when I was a little child, I never thought about getting married or having children. It's just not part of my life. I've got nieces and nephews, and come from a large family. but I think everybody's life is different, and I don't feel like I'm not part of this world because I'm not leaving a progeny behind. We're all part of this type of humanity that's going through. You know, hopefully we can keep the world going enough. Not the story.
Let's hope
that it can continue. But I think we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm being left out by not having children.
So is it time to
stop? We
could certainly continue the conversation out over tea or whatever. So I'm happy to hear more. I would like to hear what the rest of you wanted to say.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.